They have agreed to convene a meeting of their high-level staff next week to continue these very important discussions, which may be followed by yet another meeting between President Trump and President Putin.
That was just moments ago with Caroline Leavitt from the White House saying that this phone call that we told you about this morning that was going on between President Trump and President Putin has resulted in another meeting and another phone call, first with a high level delegation next week, as Caroline said right there, and then potentially also between the heads of state themselves shortly after that. Now, we had originally titled this show Trump Turning on the Heat on Russia and Venezuela, and a lot of boisterous statements came out of the White House yesterday. And now that we see this statement coming out here, and we got to say, wait, what happened to the heat? Because a rather different tone in there. And we'll get to some of this in a second, but you'll see that Zelensky had a very different expectation. But now that you see that Trump is talking about meeting, but he revealed this. And again, this is just moments ago. So let me just read this to kind of put all this stuff in context. President Trump writes, "I have just concluded my telephone conversation with President Vladimir Putin of Russia, and it was a very productive one. President Putin congratulated me and the United States on the great accomplishments of peace in the Middle East, something that he said he has dreamed of for centuries." I'm not sure how he's been dreaming for centuries, but we'll leave that as it was. What's moving there? He said, "I actually believe that the success in the Middle East will help our negotiations in attaining an end to the war with Russia and Ukraine." President Putin thanked the First Lady Melania for her involvement with children. He was very appreciative and said that he will continue. "We also spent a great deal of time talking about trade between Russia and the United States when the war is over." That's another common thing that Putin always goes back to. "At the conclusion of the call, we agreed that there will be a meeting of our high-level advisors next week. The United States' initial meetings will be led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, together with various other people to be designated. A meeting location to be determined. President Putin and I will then be agreed upon the location, Budapest, Hungary," interesting location there, I think it's a good one, "to see if we can bring this inglorious war between Russia and Ukraine to an end. President Zelensky and I will be meeting tomorrow in the Oval Office, where we will discuss my conversation with Putin and much more. I believe great progress was made with today's phone call and conversation." Okay, if you just looked at that at face value as it was, then you would think that's awesome. That's good, because President Trump, President Putin got on the phone. They said, "Hey, we want to bring this thing to an end. Let's get our high-level people. This is the way it's supposed to work. Let's get our high-level people together to talk first and see if we can hammer out something and get close to whatever we would agree on. And then the next visit would be between us, and then we would hammer out some kind of end to this inglorious war," it says. But you can't take it in isolation, because it exists in the panoply of all of these other things that are swirling around, many of which were said just yesterday, many of it are roiling around in Europe yesterday and today even. And this also has to be taken in context with the Alaska meeting. Remember, at the end of that meeting, President Trump said he was really optimistic and hopeful that we would get to an end to the war in that case. And then you may recall, right after it, he said that, yeah, we're going to have a bilateral meeting between Russia and between Putin and Zelensky, and then probably a trilateral later on in the month of August, he said. And then that way we'll bring the whole thing to an end. They want me there, he said, because I can help bring it to an end. Nothing happened after that. Russia ended up saying, "We haven't changed our position. We're saying the same thing we've always said. All of our conditions have to be met." Putin subsequently said, "We're either going to solve this at the negotiating table or we're going to solve it on the battlefield." He's never said anything besides that. And so now, in the context of this one, even in the near term, this was being pitched because President Trump, in another Truth Social about 10 or so days ago, Russia's a paper tiger. And as it turns out, Ukraine can drive and go all the way back to the 1991 borders, and who knows, maybe even beyond that, so he said. And then we have, and now in the near term, Trump saying, "I might give them Tomahawk missiles. As a matter of fact, if they don't get this thing solved, I'm going to bring some Tomahawks into this equation here." And of course, Zelensky's jumping all over that. He's like, "Absolutely, yes, that's what we need. We need more sanctions, and we need more long-range fires, specifically Tomahawks." And so he's got his team here. Gary showed yesterday all those videos and photographs of of Zelensky's team meeting with Raytheon and a lot of other defense contractors. Everybody thumbs up, big smiles on their face because they were all happy about making economic deals and buying all these long-range weapons and air defense interceptors, all kinds of stuff. And now Zelensky with his team here and ready to come tomorrow, he's thinking he's going to get authorization to use Tomahawks against Russia. And then Trump kind of upends the whole thing and says, you know, a lot of progress was going to be made. He said absolutely nothing in this conversation about Tomahawk missiles. He didn't say anything about putting pressure on Russia. He just says, hey, we're going to have a talk next week, and I think we can bring it to an end. No clue about what that means or how he's talking about doing it. And if history is any guide, it's pretty unlikely that Russia agreed on this phone call to submit to Trump's terms. It's pretty unlikely that he's going to say, all right, we'll change everything we've been saying. Well, I don't know, go back to February of 2022 or April of 2022 in Istanbul. Probably not the case. And for sure, it's virtually unthinkable that it wasn't, that the Tomahawk issue was on the table when they had their phone call. So Trump has made this threat. We've shown you earlier in the show today and yesterday that the Russians were not happy about this. I think we showed you earlier the British, the Russian ambassador to Britain was on television this morning saying that there would be consequences if that happened. He refused to say what those were, but he said it would be a definite escalation. His arm did that. I mean, he didn't say it would be up. I mean, he physically moved his hand way up there to indicate it would be a significant escalation. So for sure, that was on the agenda here. We'll be waiting real eager to see what the Russian readout of this is. Well, if we get anything on the air before we get off, we'll certainly bring that to you. But I can't imagine that Russia is going to have changed. So if they didn't, then the question is, upon what basis will this meeting have that they're going to bring to an end? What has changed? Something has to change because the two sides have been on polar opposites, and they've been that way for a long time. Nothing happened to narrow the gap after Alaska, and certainly nothing in the interim time and or recent times has done anything but expand the difference between the two sides. So what is giving him optimism right now? That's the million-dollar question that we'd really like an answer to. And we're not going to get that in the moment here. So the only thing we can do is see what led up to this moment. How did we get here today? And I'm talking about just in the last 24 to 36 hours. A lot of things have been said, and you have to view everything I just read there in the context of the last bit of time here, because those things all coexist. We got to try to make some sense of it. Well, let's go first of all to this issue of where yesterday President Trump was convinced that he had the leverage and the pressure points to actually bring Russia to heel by putting pressure on India.
There will be no oil. He's not buying his oil from Russia. It started. You know, he can't do it immediately. It's a little bit of a process. But the process is going to be over with soon. And all we want from President Putin is stop this. Stop killing Ukrainians and stop killing Russians, because he's killing a lot of Russians. Again, it doesn't make him look good. It's a war that he should have won in 1 week, and he's now going into his fourth year. That does not make this big so-called war machine look good. But he could make a settlement. We're willing to settle. I thought we had a deal. The hatred of the two leaders is very, you know, it's an obstacle. It's an obstacle. There's no question about it. But I thought we had a deal 2 months ago. Who would think I created peace in the Middle East and can't get the two guys to settle? But I think we'll get them. But if India doesn't buy oil, it makes it much easier.
So, lot to unpack there. But let's start off with some of the bits. He said, listen, all I'm asking Russia to do, it's just stop killing people. So not that I'm looking at any of the reasons why Russia said that they went to war, and what they said the conditions are absolutely essential and required to bring it to an end. No discussion about that at all. No acknowledgement that that even exists. Just stop killing. Like Trump seems to think that all we have to do is get Zelensky and Putin to say, all right, war's over. That's it. Wherever the line of contact is now, that's where it's going to stop. So we just want to stop the killing. That solves absolutely nothing, and it satisfies neither one of them. There's no way Zelensky would ever be satisfied with that himself. And there's no way that Russia would ever be satisfied. Both of them have unequivocally said that, Zelensky said that we will never give away our territory. We're not going to sign anything away. He only said that the current line of contact would begin conversations. And he has in recent days said, no, we want to continue fighting. That's all they are interested in. It's all the Ukraine, the European side are interested in, helping continue fighting the war. And then now Trump is forgetting about what is exists on the Russian side and what they say that they need, or how just stopping the killing would satisfy anyone in Russia that would lead to a sustainable end of hostilities. Because in order to have this more than just a ceasefire, in order to have it to where the war comes to an end, you have to address the fundamentals. And that means one of two major, primarily one of two things. Either both sides have to say, all right, here is the minimum that I can live with. And if these conditions are met, then I can at least live with this. We can stop the war and there doesn't need to be another one. I can't even imagine any circumstances where any set of circumstances exist that both sides would be acknowledged. They would be willing to accept. Maybe it exists. I can't imagine it. That's one method though. But if you don't have that, then the war can't come to an end that way through an agreed upon, just negotiated settlement. The other way is that one side does one of two things there. Either, and of course, this is only the Russian side, either they say, here are my conditions, and because I'm in the position of superiority and power, that I will give on this tiny one and this tiny one, and you'll give on this basket load over here. And if you give on the basket load, then we have an end to the conflict. And if the weaker side, the Ukraine side, says, I'll just have to hold my nose and live with it, and sure, we'll go along with that. That can also end it. Or the alternative way on number two is that Russia just wins the war and that Russia just continues grinding down the Ukraine military until it's not able to offer resistance, whether that's another 3 or 4 months and the military falls apart, or whether they continue doing like the Germans did in World War II, then they stay and they fight to the bitter end. And it could be a year, 2 years more. In fact, it could possibly be that way. Russia can do that, because they have the wherewithal, they have the military infrastructure, they have the defense industrial base, they have the manpower. They have everything that you need to do that. Even if it took that much time, they can do it. The Ukraine side can't. The Ukraine side can't get into a war of attrition and win. They just don't have the inputs in any category. So what then is the basis for President Trump saying he's going to bring this war to an end and he's optimistic now? What changed between yesterday and today? Now, one of the things he mentioned in that clip there was, I'm going to bring pressure on India and put them pressure to stop. And he claimed that he talked to Modi and he agreed to it. But when you talk just hours ago, today, the Indians are singing a different tune.
I'm not aware of any conversation yesterday between the two leaders. We have noticed the latest sanctions announced by the UK, as I have said this earlier as well, and possibly most of you are aware of it as well, that we do not subscribe to any unilateral sanctions. Government of India considers the provision of energy security a responsibility of paramount importance to meet the basic needs of its citizens. Indian companies source energy supplies from around the world, while taking overall market conditions into account.
So India's saying, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. There was no phone call, and we're going to do what makes sense for us in our economic security, our national security. And I can't think of any scenario where India would say, okay, you know what? Sure. We're going to abandon Russia. We're just going to leave them behind. We're going to cut off. I want to say it's like 40% of their petroleum products come from Russia. And we're just going to stop that, right? We're just going to quit it, whether fast or slow. What are you going to replace it with? Where are you going to get 40% of your global energy inputs elsewhere? And as the Indians said also, and I think this was yesterday when this comment was first made, India said, look, what are you even talking about? It was the United States under the Biden administration that asked us to do this so that the global price of oil would not blow up back when all this stuff happened earlier in the war. They said, we're just doing what you ask us to do. And now all of a sudden you're putting the screws on us to tell us to do the opposite. But they can't, because now then you see they're buying this 40%. It's not even a matter of can you get 40% elsewhere. That would be really challenging for the global supply. Right now, it's in relative equilibrium between supply and demand. And if you now stop taking from one source 40%, then where else are you going to get it? Because the other sources are going somewhere else. It's a zero-sum situation. If they're going to now all of a sudden all the other global suppliers are going to start giving you that map, making up that 40%. It's got to come from somewhere. So somebody who's buying it right now won't be able to. And then what is that going to leave? They're going to have to get it from Russia somewhere else. You can't take that much petroleum off the market and it not have an effect everywhere else. And even if that could somehow be found, then the price for India for that, because they get all this 40% at a discounted rate, a significant discounted rate. Now you're going to be asking them to get the same percent somewhere else and at market rates. And that means that all of their economic activity and production will now come at a much higher cost, which will have a significant downward effect on their economy. Not something most politicians are eager to get done for no benefit to themselves, just to make the president of the United States happy. So that seems pretty unlikely it's going to happen. So if people are going to be saying, and I can see some people doing it, saying, oh, it was President Trump's threat of Tomahawk missiles and the threat that China or India was going to stop buying Russian oil, and that is what caused Putin to come to the table and meet here. I'm sure people are going to say that, especially those who supported the president. They'll say his coercive diplomacy worked yet again, and now, great, we have this situation here. I'm not on the inside, so I can't really say for sure on that. But I can tell you, with history as a guide, that's pretty unlikely. And we won't have to wait very long to find out. Whatever happens with these high-level delegations next week, and then whatever is set on the table for the heads of state, assuming that even happens, that's what's going to really tell us. Now, if those meetings come out, and it turns out that Russia has backed off of their maximalist demands, and all of a sudden they're not requiring all of this stuff. They're not requiring Ukraine to withdraw out of all of the four administrative borders of the areas that they annexed. If they're not talking about demilitarization, if they're not talking about denazification, then I'm going to have to say, all right, turns out my assessment was wrong. Hats off to President Trump because he figured it out. But I doubt seriously I'll be doing that. But I'm going to go on record to say, and if that happens, then okay. But it seems pretty unlikely to me that that's the case. So I don't think you should be pinning your hopes too much on that. And one who is pinning his hopes on that is Volodymyr Zelensky, who earlier today, in eager anticipation of his meeting tomorrow in the Oval Office with President Trump, said this.
We have also already prepared our part of the homework ahead of the meeting with President Trump, both the military component and the economic one. Every detail, everything is ready. The agenda of our meeting with the President of the United States is very substantive, and I thank everyone who is helping. This can truly bring the war closer to an end. There is a new sanctions package from Britain. There are dozens of people who help Russia fight. And there is also a ship of the Russian fleet carrying oil. We will definitely synchronize this package in our jurisdiction and work so that other partners equally put pressure on Russia for the sake of a real end, an end to the war. Putin should earn less, and then there will be more security in the world. And things like Patriot and Tomahawks can lay a long-term foundation for peace.
So you see that Zelensky is completely devoid of rationality. He's completely talking about what he wants to be true. So he's saying, yes, sanctions, increased sanctions from the UK. And I think there's a 19th package in the European Union that's in process of being developed, et cetera. They want to go after the shadow fleet. They want to curtail Russia's ability to even sell its oil on the international market by any means. And then, of course, the military aspect. He wants more Patriot interceptors, and he wants the long-range stuff, which is the Tomahawks, as he specified there. Those things, he says, will bring peace. Never has he described how that's going to happen. Never has anyone in the Western European side described how that would happen, how more sanctions, when the first 18 packages didn't work, when everything we've tried to do to destroy the Russian economy has not worked. There are some problems with the Russian economy. It is slowed down in its growth. There is an issue with inflation. There's some difficulties. But from Larry Johnson, who was in Moscow yesterday and gave us a firsthand report, we've had conversations earlier today from the Ambassador Ian Proud, or former diplomat Ian Proud, who used to serve in Russia and still has people on the ground and sources in Russia. And he says he's asked. And they said, no, there are some difficulties here and there. There are a few regions where there's been some gasoline rationing, but minor comparatively. And he said, otherwise, the quality of life continues on. There's no suffering. There's certainly no protesting. There's no angry people. So all of that is a myth that's created on our side. And we think that somehow, even though all these other things have failed, maybe next time it's going to work. And so the idea that more sanctions and then now more offensive weapons, and even according to what's being talked about, is possible for the United States to give somewhere around 20 to 50 long-range weapons. That is a drop in the bucket. The idea that that's going to cause Russia material damage or that's going to change the nature of the war means that you don't understand how these things work and you've not been paying any attention to what has been happening on the ground in Ukraine with Russian long-range missiles that there's almost nothing you can do to stop them. The long-range drones that are just crushing your country from left to right. And yet that doesn't knock Ukraine out of the war. And we're not talking 50, folks. We're talking sometimes 50 missiles in a day, and you're talking about hundreds, sometimes up to 600-700 of these long-range drones in a day. And this is now pervasive. There have been literally thousands of missiles, long-range missiles from the Russian side that have hit plenty of targets and caused substantial damage throughout Ukraine, and it is caused them problems on the front line. It has made life very difficult for them, and it weakens their front, but you see it hasn't collapsed. So by what possible rational logic can you think that a small handful of these missiles is going to bring Russia, the whole of Russia, to its knees when thousands of them haven't brought this much smaller Ukraine to its knees? It's irrational and it's illogical, and yet that's what we're pinning hope on there. And if Zelensky is irrational, you can kind of understand that. It's less understandable, though, why an American retired four-star general also thinks the same.
They're in about a 40-foot shipping container, and the top flips up, and there's four launchers there with four missiles. Pretty imaginative idea. So that's what's at play here. And what would Ukraine do? To emphasize again to our viewers, they're not going to attack any civilian targets. They're not going to attack a population center like Moscow. The people wringing their hands saying this is an expansion of the war. This is a military escalation, much like we did in the Middle East, to what? To end the war.
Yeah.
The motivation here is not to protract the war, it's to end it.
Yeah, terrific. The idea is to end the war, not to protract it. And how is that going to happen, Jack? How is that supposed to happen? How are 50 freaking missiles, most of which would almost certainly be shot down? Because everybody needs to understand this. Whatever the number is, we are going to give our oldest, least capable stuff first. We are not going to give our high-end, most capable stuff because, number one, we don't want Russia to figure out how to defeat those things in the event that we ever need them. So we're going to use the older stuff, the stuff that Russia knows already and that they have the capacity to shoot down. It's not clear that any of them would get through. Probably some would, but they're not hypersonic missiles, so they can be shot down, and Russia does have the capabilities to do that. So only some small number is going to get through. How then do you argue that that is going to cause Russia to just fold its camp and quit? I mean, there's no rationale to that. I mean, everything we have thrown at Russia militarily, I just mentioned all of the economic instruments. Look at all of the weapon systems, the armaments, the Storm Shadows, the ATACMs, the HIMARS, all of these things that we put out there. Russia figured them all out and neutralized all of them. And even though a lot of them did get through and cause damage, Russia figured it out and they can handle it. They made adjustments like happens all the time in war. It did not stop them. It didn't even prevent them from continuing its offensive. That continues on to this day. So if General Keane is going to say this can change the dynamic, then he has to show, rationally speaking, and say point A, point B, point C equals point D. Point D being Russia folds its arms, folds up its camp, and decides to quit because they calculate that they can't win anymore. What is A, B, and C? Show me how a handful of older Tomahawk missiles, the cruise missiles, How is that, that most of which won't get through, that are older ones, how are they going to get through? And then whatever they strike, how is that going to change from what Ukraine's already doing? By the way, they've had a number of their own long-range drones and some of these other things that they've developed in, internally. They get through sometimes. And you've seen all those fires from Bryansk, from several Russian cities, Ingalls Air Base. I mean, these things are getting through there. Has that caused Russia to collapse? Has that caused them to fold up their tents? I mean, it doesn't, and that's already happening. So why do you think that it's going to happen here? What it could do, though, is escalate the situation because, as the Russians have said and pointed out recently, the Tomahawk can be equipped with a nuclear warhead. And are we ready to hope that Russia just says, hope it's not a nuclear bound on this one? Because you can't tell. The radar signature is identical. It's a missile that doesn't know what's inside, what kind of warhead it has. Are we going to bank on that Russia will just assume that it's not and then not take any action, knowing that it literally could end up wiping out command and control center somewhere? That's not something I want to find out. And there's no value to us in doing that because in the event that it was, then obviously it's thermonuclear war. It's self-destruction for everybody. So I can't imagine that we would do that. But why put Russia in a position to have to respond? Because they could use that as just saying, okay, you want to play that game? Here comes a tactical nuke. The minute that I see that in the air, here comes a tactical nuke in response. I doubt they would do that. I mean, God forbid that they would, and I hope that they don't. But why risk that they might? Because that is a potential response that they could have. The Russian ambassador to the UK earlier today said that he would consider it a significant escalation. He didn't say what it was because he's a diplomat. They don't talk about that stuff, but that's one of the possibilities. Why would we want to find that out? And when you have these guys going on television with this credibility, these four stars on their chest or retired and all the medals that they had and the credibility that we ascribe to them, even though they rarely earn it, why do you want to listen to these guys when they don't even tell you how it's going to work? They just say, yeah, it's magic. It's going to work. That works on TV. That works for a lot of the audience who has no idea. And they're understandably, they're moved by somebody who is a retired four-star general. So they listen to that. The Russians don't. They're not stupid. Vladimir Putin definitely is not. All these things I've talked about, probably a lot more, he's well aware of them. He knows exactly what is and isn't possible and what can and can't happen and what the real balance of power is. And again, unless there's something that we don't know in public yet, I can't even imagine anything that President Trump was going to be able to bring to bear on that phone call that's going to cause Russia to change from the position it is nonstop, consistently held since April of 2022. We're going to have to wait and see. When we do, then we'll make a new assessment there. But most likely, this is going to end like the Anchorage did, where Trump has all these high expectations and hopes, but there's no foundation, there's no fundamentals behind it. And with the Russians saying that I can take anything you can give, whether economic or a handful of missiles, it's not going to change the dynamic on the ground. So there's no reason why they should. But Putin still, he's talking about, that Trump mentioned in there, he's talking about after the war. He's talking about trade. Putin wants to have a strategic arms limitation treaty for the one that's about to expire in February, not long from now. So Putin does want to have a deal. He does want to have long-term relations with the United States because he knows that's in his interest, and he knows it's in global security interest. So there is room for things, but I cannot imagine that Putin is going to not require what he needs domestically to succeed. Because just imagine for a moment, the domestic audience in Russia, who also is really well aware of these things, if they see their government and their leader, Vladimir Putin, say, okay, from a position of power with the capability to cause a lot more trouble and a lot more death and destruction on the Ukraine side than they have done so far, he then capitulates to the personality of Trump and agrees to end not on their maximalist terms, but significantly allowing Ukraine to exist in some form, to allow Zelensky to stay in power. No demilitarization, no denazification, as the Russians might define it. He would not survive in office. You want to talk about the potential for the people rising up against it? It's not because of economic hardship. It would be because he gave the farm away when he had the power to demand full compliance. See, and you talk about somebody, what Putin is focused on, like every other leader, he's really focused on his domestic more so than the international. And I I just cannot even imagine a scenario that anything we would bring to bear would be able to change that. We'll have to wait and see. Who knows? Maybe there's something we don't know that could change this. If the war is over, then, you know, I'm going to be the first one to cheer, even if it's not what I thought, because that's the ultimate objective, because then that gets the risk of escalation and the development of a West on East war that could go nuclear off the table, or at least significantly diminish it. But we'll have to wait and see what it happens. We'll see what the Russian readout of this is when it comes out. We'll also see what happens next week when these high-level delegations get together. A couple of other things I want to talk about here today, and I mentioned at the outset of this, because we had already planned on talking about this, and it is important to mention here, and that is this issue with Venezuela. As you may be aware, there have been lots of discussions about boats blowing up. There have been five of them. Trump touts them every single time. He says this is about, we're going to bring peace. And we're going to end the situation with drugs coming into our country. And he has chosen to go after Venezuela, even though drugs come from all over South America in many different places. Lots of places are transited on the sea, in the air, and on the ground. And for some reason, he has chosen to go after Venezuela. Now, we can speculate a lot of the reasons why. It could have something to do with oil in Venezuela. I don't know. I don't want to talk about those things just yet, but I do want to zero in on what is really going on and what is the legality of this and what is the effectiveness of it. So first of all, I want to show, here's what President Trump said yesterday about the Venezuelan boats.
When they're loaded up with drugs, they're fair game. They're speedboats. They're extremely fast, record-setting type speedboats that cost a lot of money, and they have a lot of money because they're drug sellers. There's drug dust. They call it drug dust. They call it fentanyl dust all over the boat after those bombs go off, and you can take along. We know before. We know when they go out. We know we have much information about each boat that goes out. Deep, strong information.
Okay, really zero in on that last part. We know who's going in. We know all the boats that are happening, what's on them. Deep, deep information, he says there. Now, remember that in just a second. That's really, really important. But before even getting there, what's even more important is, what is the legality of this? Now, I know that many people, especially supporters of Trump, aren't concerned about that anymore. They don't worry about that. They say if international law inhibits us and prevents us from keeping our country safe, they can all go to hell. Don't care. Well, we need to care, because there is a right way to do things. There's a right way to do the right thing, and there's the wrong way to do the right thing. There should be no question in anybody, definitely not for me, that it should be a priority for the United States and something, an objective we should all get behind, which is to block the entry into the United States of illegal, illicit drugs. We do have not just a fentanyl, but we have all kinds of problems with drugs throughout our country. And it is a major issue. I think it's like 100,000 people die every year from overdoses and other problems like that. It leads to organized crime. There's the cartels actually have locations in our country here and there where they're on the receiving end of a lot of these things. All kinds of bad things about it. Every bit of it is bad, and it should be gone after. But there is a right way and a wrong way to do it. We dare not, hear me, we dare not get into a situation to where we say an end justifies the means, because we want this to happen. And if the law gets in our way, screw the law. Get it out of here. Because when you go down that path, you don't just shred that law. You lower the threshold in everybody's mind. Any other law that we don't like, we'll get rid of that too. And when you get into a situation to where the rule of law doesn't even exist anymore, we're getting dangerously close to that place, I'll tell you, not just here, across the board, many things. Then you get to the point to where there is only the rule of the power, where only the power dominates. And you can make an argument that has always been existed to some extent in international politics. But it's also true that at least trying to adhere to international law has helped keep the world safe since the end of World War II, especially. And it has curtailed those that are strong, and it has put inhibitions on them and slowed them down in many cases. But when you get rid of the rule of law and you say, I don't care, I want to do it because I want to do it, and I don't care whose rights I violate, I don't care who I kill, I don't care whose whose interests somewhere else we just get rid of, because you're no longer even looking at anything from anybody else's perspective. You're just saying, to hell with all of you, whoever you happens to be in any case, this is what I want, so I'm going to take it because I can, because I have the power. That may work today. That may work tomorrow. But hear me, there will come a time to when the sands of time start shifting and things start rolling over, and who was on the bottom now all of a sudden starts to be on the top. And we who have been on the top, we may not have that power. And then I promise you, there will be actors all over the planet who will never forget that when they were on the bottom, the rule of law went out the window, and it will stay out the window when the power dynamics reverse to our harm. We should do everything that we can to make sure we do the right thing for the right reason in the right way. And if you want to stop drugs from coming into the United States, let's build up our border security. I'm all for that. Let's try to prevent the drugs from coming in inside of our own country. Let's get at the issues that have to do with the demand side. Why are so many people doing illegal and illicit drugs? What can we do? These are hard things. There's no easy way to any of this stuff. But that's what you got to do if you actually want to get to the problem. Give people a reason and do what you can to try and wean people off of this and to make it no longer, you know, socially attractive or making it easy for people to do drugs, et cetera. Again, super, super hard thing. I don't in any way minimize how it is, but you got to fight after that. And right now, that's not even on the table. We don't even worry about that part of the equation. No, we just want to start with this going in here. And of course, anyone who's looking at this situation understands that when you look at all of the issues going from South America, where all the drugs come into the country, where the processes are on the sea, in the air, on the ground, transit points, et cetera, stuff that comes in through illegal means, stuff that is hidden away in legal trade that comes in, and how difficult that is to find. You understand it's a multifaceted problem. You also have to understand that if you start going after cartels, that look at other governments in our hemisphere that have done that, the cartels don't just lay down, folks. It's not even like the Taliban. These folks have lots of power, lots of technology, and they are vicious and wicked. And if you start interdicting and actually harming their organization, they strike back. They have ways to do it. And we don't want to get into a tit-for-tat war, especially if it turns into happening on our own soil. This is not a situation to where it's like a dominant power and a weakling down there, and we'll just slap them a few times and blow up a few boats and everything will be fine. It's not going to work that way. If you keep going down this path, they're going to fight back, and it's going to be ugly. And we don't want to get into that war right in our own backyard. And God help us if it comes into our front yard, which I suspect that it would. And the way we can avoid that then is doing what I just mentioned, following the law. And when you see these boats, interdict them. President Trump was asked that the other day, and he dismissed it. He said, no, that's woke policies or some ridiculous thing like that, and it doesn't work. So we're going to do it this way. There is no legal justification for killing people. 27 dead so far. There's no justification of it. There is no international law. There's no American law that allows you to just designate someone who's moving drugs and to kill them. That's extrajudicial execution. It violates everything about international law. It violates the spirit of American law, due process, anything else. And it's just stupid because it denies you intelligence. When you capture these folks, you find out who they are, where they came from, who they work for. Maybe you can even get them to turn for you. But if not, you can know who they were, where they came from. You can track them backwards. And then you can finally have a chance to actually get at the cartels of that through legal means. From helping other countries if you need to. But that way you can identify where it is. By just blowing it up in there, it makes great video, makes you look tough to a domestic audience, but it hampers your ability to actually inhibit the drug trade. It doesn't help you. So you shred the rule of law, you make us look like a great bully, and it makes people angry around the world, and it denies us the ability to actually harm and go after the networks where this stuff came from. So all that is the case here. Now, I was on a show in Great Britain where they had a local office here in Washington, D.C., so I was actually on there. Well, just before I went on, I saw an interview with a podcaster Katrina Schultz is her name. She has a button. She covers these issues all the time with border security and drug trade and all that kind of stuff. And I was really impressed with what she had. And I wanted to show you her comments about some of the things that Trump just said.
This is a little bit different in Venezuela because we're seeing high levels over the last couple of months in Mexico, particularly transferring fugitives from Mexico into the U.S. But this is a little bit different in Venezuela because we're seeing high-level military action. And truth be told, we're not getting a ton of information on who is being targeted in those strikes. Okay, we know that they're narco boats and they allegedly are carrying meth and fentanyl from Venezuela and other Central American countries into Mexico to then be distributed across the United States. But we're not getting names of who these individuals are. And the reason I bring this up is because, of course, I have reported on this extensively from high level to the lowest level of narcos or foreign terrorists. And we've seen names in press releases, on the OFAC press releases, you name it, no matter who it is, okay? A Mexican national who's trafficking arms from El Paso into Juarez, Mexico, we get their full name. Here, we're not hearing any names of, I think it's around 27 people who have been killed already.
So you see that that's so many things are out of that place. 27 people have been killed. Ordinarily, you would say, we killed these people. Remember, at the end of that soundbite by Trump I showed you a second ago, he said, we have deep intelligence. We know all of this stuff. Well, if you know this stuff, why would you not tell anybody? We don't know the name of a single person on there. And according to the New York Times a couple of days ago, one of these boats, they think actually came from Colombia. And the senior administration officials who remained anonymous that they talked to said, we assess that it came from here, meaning they don't know. So if you know, if they were lying, the administration officials were lying, but President Trump is telling the truth, then you would be able to tell us, like has been the case for all of this time, for as long as I can remember, no matter what president is in office at any time. You should know, here's who we killed, here's what they were doing, here's how much drug was on board. You claim you know all that stuff. Now, as I pointed out, that doesn't make it legal, but this tells you that they probably don't know. And if that's the case, then that's an even bigger red flag, because now then we have killed 27 people. And one report I read actually suggests that one of them may have actually been a fishing boat, might not have been a drug runner at all. I don't know. Neither does anybody else. And it's not clear that the president does. But the fact is, we're given orders to kill people like it's nothing. 27 people here so far. And listen, knocking out, you get back to the effectiveness issue, knocking out a handful of speedboats in the middle of the Caribbean Sea is going to do nothing to the drug problem in our country. I mean, you realize that there are, you know, tons of illicit drugs come into the United States all the time. And so whatever you can fit on some of these boats is a tiny fraction of it. And by the way, not one of those boats actually had the capacity to get to the United States. We don't know where it was heading. It could have been going any number of places. So who knows if it even limited what was coming in, assuming that they were, for the moment, they actually were all drug boats. And that first one, you may recall when we covered it, the video shows it looked like there might have been a few suitcases in the back. It was not hardly loaded, and that you would have that many. I think it was 11 people that were allegedly on that boat and what looked like a handful of bags. And even if you said, yeah, that's drugs, what kind of drug operation is that going to be? We're going to put 11 guys on a boat with a handful of drugs? No, you're going to do the opposite. You're going to have maybe two guys on the boat to operate it, and the rest is going to be stuffed with drugs. That's how it works. They're not inefficient. They're going to be efficient in what they do. So even according to what we have been seeing, it's just a fraction, just a little fraction of what's going on here. Yeah, that's the one right there. Thanks, Gary. Brilliant. You see all these guys, 11 of them in the front of the boat, and you see at most what looks like some suitcases and other bags and backpacks in the back. So that doesn't give us a lot of confidence that our government is actually stopping drug trade into the United States, and there's no path forward. And then this is not unlike what we were talking about earlier with the whole issue of the Russia-Ukraine war and how we want to bring tomahawks in. There's no concept for how that's actually going to impact the actual war. There's just, hey, we can do it, so let's do it. Hey, we have the technology. We can kill these guys, so let's kill them. No idea how that's going to actually contribute to the larger issue, and ignoring how this kind of thing has worked in the past. There's a reason why the war on drugs, I think during the Reagan administration, was a complete fiasco and a disaster, never worked at all. There's a reason why they might have wanted to check that out and do some analysis before they started this one, and it doesn't appear that there was. So, folks, this is not a good thing for the United States. We're playing with a dangerous game continuing on, just like we did when we attacked Iran. This continues the process of violating our own constitution, our own laws, and saying that the administration is above the law and that the ends justify the means, even though it's not accomplishing even the means themselves. It's not even accomplishing the ends, but it is violating the law, and it is setting up this continued normalization of blowing off any laws that we don't like, and nothing's ever done about it. That's not a good thing for our country, folks. It's not a good thing within our borders, and it's not a good thing for our national security outside, because time will change one day, and things could look very, very different than they do today. And at that time, we are really going to want people to obey the rule of law. We're going to see how that works out. But we'll continue to track all these things for you like we always do. Really appreciate you coming on today. We will keep you up to date because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth that you need to make sense of your world. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.